Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
Good to be here.
Today we're looking at the situation in the Afrin district of Syria, specifically the period before 2010.
Right. It's a region bordering Turkey, significant Kurdish population, and, well, it saw quite a bit of demographic change even before the civil war really kicked off.
We've got some research materials that shed some light on why people might have been leaving their villages there prior to the major conflict.
Yeah, and our focus today is really trying to understand those forces behind the population movement, the pre-2010 shifts in Afrin.
So we'll be examining things like political pressures, land issues, socioeconomic factors.
Even environmental conditions, yeah.
Yeah.
But all as they were before 2011. The goal is to grasp the sort of longer-term trends, the underlying issues that were affecting Kurdish communities there.
Okay, so based on the sources, where do we start? What was maybe the most foundational issue creating instability for Kurds in Afrin back then?
The material seems to point towards, well, systemic discrimination by the state. Absolutely. That really is the bedrock context here. It created an environment where, you know, stable community life for Kurds was constantly being undermined.
And a huge part of that was statelessness, wasn't it?
A massive part. You have to go back to the 1962 census in Alasaka. It stripped something like 120,000 Syrian-born Kurds of their citizenship.
Right. They were classified as Ajanib foreigners, or Maktumin, meaning unregistered.
Exactly. And by 2010, that number, the estimate for stateless Kurds in Syria, had ballooned to around 300,000 people.
Wow. And this wasn't just, like, a bureaucratic label, it had real severe consequences.
Oh, completely. Being stateless meant denial of basic rights across the board, civil, political, economic, social.
Like what specifically?
Well, but think about formal employment. Big barriers there. Banned from the public sector, restrictions in private jobs too. Access to healthcare was limited. There was that 2007 regulation about health books, for example.
Okay.
Education too. Hurdles for enrollment. Kids couldn't get official certificates, which basically blocked higher education for...
And that's therapy. Owning land.
Very restricted. Plus limits on political participation, freedom of movement.
Yeah.
It permeated everything.
It just sounds like this constant grinding insecurity. And on top of this legal disadvantage, the sources talk a lot about the suppression of Kurdish identity itself.
Yes, that's the other major pillar. The Ba'athist ideology was intensely Arab nationalist. It actively aimed to suppress any non-Arab identities.
How did that play out on the ground?
Things like banning Kurdish language teaching in schools, severe restrictions on any Kurdish publications.
Even cultural events. I think Nowruz was mentioned.
Yeah, major cultural celebrations like Nowruz were often restricted, sometimes outright banned. And if people tried to celebrate anyway, security forces would frequently step in, sometimes violently.
And the Arabization of place names. That feels particularly insidious.
It does. Changing the names of villages and towns in Kurdish areas, including Afrin, it's a way of trying to erase history, that connection to the land.
So you couldn't use your language freely, couldn't publish, couldn't celebrate your culture.
Couldn't even use traditional place names without pushback. And Kurdish symbols, arts, any cultural expression could be criminalized. It was about forced assimilation.
And politically, what if Kurds tried to organize or advocate for rights?
Extremely difficult and dangerous.
Yeah.
Remember, the state of emergency had been enforced since 1963.
Which suspended basic rights, essentially.
Pretty much. It gave the state huge leeway. Kurdish political parties were banned, though. About 14 existed, you know, operating underground or semi-secretly by 2010. The PYD, formed in 2003, was one of those.
So any political activity was risky?
Any activity. Distributing a newsletter, holding a private meeting could get you arrested. Activists demanding basic political and cultural rights were routinely detained.
And the trials weren't exactly fair, were they? The sources mentioned special courts.
Right. The Supreme State Security Court, or military courts. People faced vague charges like weakening national sentiment or inciting sectarian strife. These were catch-alls to silence dissent.
There were examples like Azadi Party members in 2009.
Yes, and Dikiti Party members in 2010. Sentenced under these kinds of charges. It shows the pattern of political persecution.
And underpinning all this was the security apparatus, the Mukhabarat. Their role seems pervasive.
Pervasive is the right word. A network of security agencies with enormous power and almost zero accountability.
So arbitrary arrests were common.
Very common. Detention without warrants, being held incommunicado for weeks, months. Enforced disappearance was also a documented tactic against opponents, including Kurds.
Like Hasan Nawaf Rasht, disappeared in 2009.
Exactly. a chilling example. And then there's the torture in detention. The reports are widespread and, frankly, horrific.
What kinds of methods are described?
Electrical shocks, pulling out fingernails, beatings like falaka, the stress positions like shabe, sexual violence, the German chair, dulab, bisat alri. Truly brutal methods were systematically used.
The cases of Jakar Khan Ali and Claude Kenjo in 2009 were mentioned as examples of this torture.
Yes, specific documented instances.
And accountability. Could victims seek justice?
Virtually impossible. Mm-hmm. There were specific laws, like Legislative Decrees 14 and 69 from 2008, that granted immunity to security personnel for actions taken in the line of duty.
So near total impunity.
Pretty much. Which also likely explains the suspicious deaths of young Kurdish men during their compulsory military service.
Right. The sources mentioned nearly 40 between 2007 and 2010, often ruled suicides or accidents.
Despite evidence suggesting otherwise, the case of Riyad Ahmed Khalir, who died in custody in August 2010, fits this pattern. It all contributed to this climate of fear and injustice.
Oh. Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Roj Bosh, Hannah.
Ah, perfect timing.
Hmm. This smells fantastic today. A lovely hint of cardamom. Let me try it. Hmm. Yes, it's good. Very warming. Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe just a touch bitter today. Could use a tiny bit more sugar for my taste, perhaps.
Let's see. Yeah, maybe just a spoonful. It's nice, though.
Definitely. Okay, let's take a quick pause here. Enjoy this properly. Chai break. All right, we're back. Enjoyed that chai.
Hit the spot.
So we've talked about the direct repression, the statelessness, the cultural suppression, the security apparatus abuses. But the research also points to land policies and property rights being used as another lever against Kurds in Afrin.
Yes, it wasn't just direct violence or political rest. Control over land was critical. If you look historically, border regions like Afrin were always seen through a security lens by Damascus.
Going back quite a way.
Yeah, a 1952 decree already restricted building, transferring ownership, even improving land in border zones. This inherently hit Kurdish communities hard.
So limits on housing, land, property transactions, those HLP rights were in place long before, say, the 2000s.
Exactly. And those restrictions largely stayed in place right up until 2011. Then came the more explicit policies aimed at demographic change, often called the Arab Belt or sometimes Green Belt policies.
Starting in the 60s.
Yes, under the UAR and then the Ba'ath regime. The stated goal was to alter the demographic fabric of these Kurdish border regions.
By moving people around.
Essentially, yes. Settling Arab populations into Kurdish areas, displacing or marginalizing the existing Kurdish inhabitants. This often involved confiscating Kurdish-owned land and redistributing it to Arab families brought in.
Was this widespread?
There was a very ambitious plan for Al-Hasaka that was reportedly stopped in 1976, but the underlying goal didn't just disappear. And we see evidence of it being implemented in Afrin, too.
Really? In Afrin specifically?
Yes. Sources mention resettlement of Arab families from the Amirat and Bubana tribes, for example, into Afrin City, Jandaris, and villages that were previously Kurdish, especially after land reforms during the UAR period.
So direct resettlement.
And also authorizing permanent settlement for nomadic Arab herders in the area. It was part of a package, often coupled with economic measures designed to keep Kurdish areas underdeveloped, focused on agriculture, and dependent.
Limiting industrial development, that kind of thing.
Exactly. But then things got even tighter for property rights, with Decree 49 in September 2008.
Right. This required security approval from Damascus for any property deals within 25 kilometers of the border.
And since Afrin is right on the Turkish border, that covered the whole district.
What was the practical effect?
The crucial part is that security permissions were, reportedly, almost never given to Kurds for these transactions.
So it just froze the market for them.
Completely froze the legal market. Kurdish homeowners couldn't get official deeds, the Tabu Akhtar. That meant they couldn't legally sell, couldn't use property as collateral for loans, couldn't even ensure legal inheritance.
That must have created enormous anxiety, fear of just losing your land, right?
Absolutely. Fear of expropriation, of forced displacement. People did protest against Decree 49, and predictably there were arrests, including Kurds and even some Communist Party members who joined them.
So, looking at the cumulative effect on rural villages in Afrin.
It was devastating for 10-year security. Without official deeds, properties were vulnerable. And the inability to legally build, improve, or transfer property just killed any incentive for investment in farming or rural infrastructure.
Leading to economic stagnation.
Right. And it's hard not to see these policies as instruments tools of demographic engineering aimed at weakening the Kurdish presence in those strategic border areas.
Okay, so adding another layer to this complex picture, beyond the political and land issues, there's also the socioeconomic dimension and even environmental factors playing a role.
Definitely. The research consistently shows that Kurdish-majority regions, like the Northeast generally, suffered from systemic economic neglect by the state,
leading to higher poverty.
Higher poverty, higher illiteracy, higher unemployment compared to other parts of Syria. State policies actively discouraged industrial development there.
So even if you weren't stateless or directly targeted politically, just the lack of opportunity could push you out.
Exactly. Especially for young people looking for work, for a future. Many were pushed towards bigger cities like Aleppo or Damascus, or even out of the country altogether. Economic pressure was a key factor, running alongside the political repression and land insecurity.
And then there was the drought. Syria experienced a really bad one leading up to 2010.
A very severe, prolonged drought, yeah. It hit the northeast, Al-Hasakah and Deir ez-Zor, incredibly hard.
How did it affect Afrin? The sources seem a bit mixed.
One report from 2010 suggests Afrin might have been less severely affected than, say, Al-Hasakah. But given Afrin's reliance on agriculture, particularly olives, any significant drought would still have strained production and water resources.
And the scale in nearby regions was huge, right? Affecting over 1 million people.
Yes. Estimates were over 1.3 million affected. Maybe 800,000 lost their livelihoods in eastern Syria due to crop failures. And the government response was reportedly minimal.
Adding environmental stress to everything else.
Precisely. Plus, there were already pre-existing tensions with Turkey over water resources, which added another layer of vulnerability. The drought likely acted as an acute stressor, maybe a tipping point for some families already struggling.
We should probably also touch on basic services. Healthcare, education, infrastructure. Were there disparities?
The general pattern of discrimination against Kurds suggests there likely were. Stateless Kurds obviously face huge barriers accessing healthcare and education. And it's probable that rural Afrin, like other Kurdish areas, saw less investment in infrastructure, electricity, water, schools, compared to regions favored by the regime.
It all paints a picture of accumulating pressures. There's one specific event that the sources highlight as a potential catalyst for increased repression, the 2004 Qamishli Uprising.
Yes, that's a really significant event. It started, perhaps strangely, at a football match in Qamishli.
Between a Kurdish team and an Arab team?
Right. Tensions flared, security forces reportedly fired on Kurdish fans, and things escalated quickly, especially during funeral processions for those killed.
And the protests spread.
They did, fueled by years of underlying grievances. They spread to other Kurdish towns, Kobane, parts of the northeast.
How did the state react?
Brutally. Live ammunition was used against protesters. Reports indicate at least 36 people were killed, mostly Kurds, over 160 injured.
And arrests.
A massive wave. Over 2,000 people were detained in the aftermath. And again, widespread reports of torture and ill treatment of those detainees.
What was the longer-term impact of Qamishli 2004 on the security climate for Kurds?
It definitely led to a significant intensification of state repression across the board. Increased harassment, stricter bans on any Kurdish gatherings, more arrests and prosecutions of activists.
So the state basically signaled zero tolerance.
Exactly. Its violent reaction sent a clear message. It probably crushed hopes for any kind of gradual reform and reinforced the view of the state as purely an antagonist. This likely accelerated immigration from places like Afrin.
Although, paradoxically, the sources also suggest it might have spurred more political organization.
That's true. About 7 new Kurdish parties were apparently formed between 2004 and 2010. So increased repression, but also perhaps increased resolve among some to organize, albeit clandestinely.
Okay, so we have this whole web of factors. Political repression, statelessness, land policies, economic neglect, environmental stress, intensified security after 2004. Is there direct evidence confirming that people were actually leaving Afrin in significant numbers before 2010?
Yes, there is. That 2010 joint report we mentioned earlier by the Danish Immigration Service and Accord explicitly documented this pre-2010 migration.
Both internal and external migration.
Both. People moving to cities like Damascus and Aleppo and people leaving Syria altogether. The report directly linked this to the systemic discrimination, the drought, and restrictive policies like Decree 49.
And it specifically mentioned Afrin, despite maybe being less hit by drought.
Yes. It explicitly stated that Afrin is also facing emigration. And the reasons cited specifically for Afrin were lack of work and intense security pressure.
Are there any figures?
Well, the report quotes a Kurdish political leader who estimated that around 300,000 Kurds had emigrated from northern and northeastern Syria in just the 2 years before the report, so roughly 2008-2009.
300,000 in 2 years, that's huge.
It is. And this emigration was reportedly causing noticeable drops in primary school enrollment, even leading to some schools closing down in those areas. Internal displacement from the drought-hit Al-Hasakah region alone was estimated at 30,000, 35,000 families, with some villages reportedly emptying out completely.
So the depopulation was real and documented before the war.
Absolutely. It seems clear that the migration and depopulation from Afrin and other Kurdish areas before 2010 wasn't random. It was a direct outcome of these cumulative long-term push factors applied by the Syrian state.
Spanning political, security, land, economic, and environmental pressures.
All working together. It was a continuous process, but one that seems to have accelerated in the late 2000s with Decree 49 and the drought adding acute pressure.
So the substantial emigration by 2010 really suggests that state policies were, perhaps intentionally, encouraging Kurdish depopulation from these strategic border zones like Afrin.
It certainly looks like sustained, multifaceted pressure was effectively making life there untenable for many Kurds, laying the groundwork for displacement long before the overt conflict started post-2011.
So wrapping this up, the picture we get of Afrin before 2010 is one of, well, steadily mounting pressure on the Kurdish population from multiple angles.
Yeah, it wasn't just one thing. It was this combination, discriminatory policies hitting basic rights, culture, land ownership, economic chances, all under this heavy security blanket.
And the emigration that was happening wasn't sudden, but really the result of these long-term systemic problems just making village life harder and harder to sustain.
Right. What's really striking is how these pre-existing conditions created this deep vulnerability, this context of displacement, well before the war that gets most of the attention.
It really makes you think about how deep the roots of the conflict were in that region.
Definitely.
And I suppose it raises the question, how does understanding these pre-2010 dynamics in Afrin help us interpret what happened after 2011?
Well, it strongly suggests the later conflicts weren't happening in a vacuum.
Yeah.
Right? They were building on decades of grievance of state policies that were already pushing people out.
So for listeners, it's a complex picture of how population displacement can happen and the really long-lasting impact state policies can have on communities.
Yeah, and it makes you wonder about other regions, too. Maybe places with similar histories of pre-conflict pressures that shaped what came later.
It's definitely a reminder that sometimes the biggest shifts we see are preceded by these long periods of, well, less visible, but incredibly powerful underlying forces at work.
Absolutely. A lot to think about there.